Rethinking High Modernism and Dam Construction in British Columbia, a roundtable on hydro in BC, and an interview with Jonathan Payton about his research on the Stikine Plateau in northern British Columbia. I'm Sean Farage, and this is episode 2 of Nature's Past, a podcast of the Network in Canadian History and Environment. In today's podcast, we focus on the environmental history of British Columbia. In particular, we consider the development of the natural resources of the province's hinterland regions. As one of the largest political jurisdictions in the Pacific Northwest, British Columbia holds a vast wealth of natural resources outside of its metropolitan center in the Lower Mainland. Since colonization, humans have exploited a wide range of resources in BC, including furs, minerals, timber, fish, and hydroelectric power. Environmental historians of British Columbia have begun to explore the history of the ecological consequences of the changing relationship between humans and non-human nature in this province. For listeners interested in reading more about BC's environmental history, I recommend picking up a copy of BC Studies' special issue on the environment, published in 2004. For details, check out our show notes at niche.uwo.ca/naturespast. This past November, the Nature History Society Group, a regional environmental history group based at Green College at the University of British Columbia, hosted a roundtable on the past and future of hydro in British Columbia. Professor Tina Liu from the Department of History at UBC spoke about the challenges environmental historians face when studying large-scale hydroelectric development projects during the period of high modernism in the mid-20th century in Canada and the United States. Through her research on state-sponsored dam construction megaprojects in parts of BC, she's come to see this era of high modernism from a different perspective regarding the place of local knowledge.
One of the ways that historians have framed and come to understand that the spurt of dam building in North America and Canada that occurred between about the 1930s and the 1980s was as a manifestation of an ideology that was characteristic of a particular moment in global history. It's what James Scott has deemed the ideology of high modernism. And as is on the slide, high modernism was essentially characterized by a belief in the power of state-sponsored megaprojects. These were projects that were informed by scientific expertise, and the power of these megaprojects to deliver social benefit on a broad scale. These were schemes designed to improve, as Scott said, the human condition. And this belief in high modernism was embraced by regimes across the political spectrum, from left to right. Well, as important as expertise and rational planning were to this ideology of high modernism, so too, Scott says, was a particular way of seeing. It's a particular way of seeing that situated people in relation to the environment in a specific way. And it's one that's exemplified by this synoptic, as in all-encompassing, bird's eye view. Now, this particular way of seeing allowed rivers to be visualized quite schematically, in terms, in this case, of their power potential. And it made this way of seeing made it possible to imagine and to implement quite grand, and in the case of Axel Weiner Grand, quite quixotic plans for river diversions on a massive, massive scale. Now, it's a way of seeing that sacrifices depth for breadth, right? You see wide, but you don't see deep. Getting a wide angle of vision necessarily reduces complexities that are visible from ground level. The high modernist point of view, this bird's eye view, is a simplified view. And this simplification has particular salience for environmental historians because it's at the root of environmental destruction and the social costs that were associated with it. Simplification strips diversity, diversity both biological and cultural. And for James Scott, that's the real tragedy of these projects, and they're also their Achilles heel. because by destroying that diversity, biological and cultural, high modernist projects actually destroy the very thing that he argues is necessary for their success, namely local knowledge. And it's the absence of local knowledge that he points to as the primary reason why these high modernist schemes to improve the human condition ultimately fail. And this makes sense, particularly if you note that Scott's an anthropologist. So he's very, very interested in local knowledge. But when you look at the dams that were built on the Nechaco River, which I'm doing some work on the Peace and on the Columbia, it's quite clear that local knowledge was not absent. Local knowledge was, in fact, implicated in the design and in the construction of these dams. The engineering studies that I've looked at for these dams are filled with reports about soils, about hydrology, and especially about geology. In the case of the Nechaco River, there was an interesting story that says something about the local knowledge that engineers had. They had to build a transmission line to get power from the Kamano powerhouse into Kitimat, where the smelters were. It wasn't very far. It was only 80 miles, I think, not kilometers. But it went over a mountain pass that was something like 1,600 meters high. And so in order to collect the information they needed to build that transmission line, the engineers from Alcan camped out over two successive winters, basically making meteorological observations about how much snow, what the drift was, how much ice there was, just so they could build the transmission line that wouldn't fail, because you don't want the smelter to lose power. They even did a very close mapping of the slope of the mountains, and they identified where it was practical to put the transmission towers, where the bolts would hold the strongest. So there's a very intimate knowledge of the landscape that comes through in all these very boring engineering reports. Now, one of the reasons that that this local knowledge is so invisible to us is because I think we focused too much on what the state saw, on these schematic drawings, like the power trench that's up here now. We focus on those instead of looking at how the people who created and implemented these drawings came to be able to make those drawings in the first place. So by focusing on this end product, the schematic, we sort of elide the whole process of visualization that gets us here. We actually look up, we overlook this long climb up to the vantage point from which the engineers and planners got their bird's eye view. So this is what I've termed the nature of engineering. I think we need to understand the nature of engineering in order to come up with a new environmental history of progress, what progress looks like from the inside. If you ask me when I started this, whether I would be, my historical project would be to rehabilitate engineers, I would never have thought it. Well, why does acknowledging the local knowledge of engineers, etc., matter? Well, first of all, I think it matters because it very fundamentally changes how we understand what local knowledge is. And I think we need to stop assuming that there is one local knowledge, and we have to stop conflating local knowledge with indigenous knowledge. There are several different kinds of local knowledges. Indigenous knowledge is one kind, but the local knowledge of these guys is another. And so our project, when we recognize local knowledges, is to understand their interplay and their competition and how one elbows out all the others. And it's interesting, even among the non-indigenous local knowledges that exist, there's a kind of jostling for position. If anybody who's worked on a construction site will know, there's always a tension between the engineers and the people who are actually, the guys that are actually doing the building. And they each assert their knowledge of the site and the process. And I think that in that regard, environmental historians can learn a lot from labor historians and just looking at the competition over knowledges and the construction of knowledges at that work site. The local knowledge of engineers, the nature of engineering, has the potential to challenge how we understand high modernism. Specifically, I think it challenges how we understand the causes of high modernist change and the impacts of those changes. First of all, if the agents of high modernism, the engineers, or like the midwives of modernity, if the agents of high modernism had local knowledge, can we really argue that it's the absence of local knowledge that's responsible for environmental destruction and negative social impacts? I think that'd be a lot harder to do. So it complicates that. I think that the decision to build these projects was political, ultimately. There was knowledge, there was local knowledge implicated in the building of the dams. There were, although we wouldn't think of them as being anywhere near as thorough as they needed to be, there were certain impact studies that were done, even in the 50s, about the environmental effects of these dams. People in power, Alcan or the government of British Columbia, decided to go ahead and build them anyway because they were using a particular calculus in determining costs and benefits. So I think we need to shift our focus from knowledge to politics. Well, if the causes of change are in question, it's not about the absence of local knowledge, then what about the impacts? It's commonplace to associate modernity with the loss of locality. So high modernist projects like dams destroy locality. And scholars who write about that destruction use terms like domicide and brute force technologies. While that's certainly true, while there certainly is the destruction of locality, I think there's more than that to say. If we think about locality as a body of knowledge rather than a place, I think we might see the impacts a little bit differently. The conceptualization and construction of all the hydro projects that I look at was very much informed by the accumulated experience that engineers and then planners and builders had gotten elsewhere. And Morrison Knudsen, which was the big engineering construction firm that worked on almost all the dams I'm looking at, is a good example. Based in Boise, but a multinational. People involved in these people were involved in designing and building the major dams in British Columbia, as I said, but they were very much part of an international community of experts that circulated from project to project around the world. And they brought that experience to bear on specific places and took their experiences in British Columbia away with them when they finished there and went on to other projects. So in that sense, I think that engineers as well as planners and builders, all of whom were agents of high modernity, deterritorialized and globalized the locales where they worked, even as the projects that they built destroyed those locales. Over time, too, and this is on the slide, the dams they built differentiated the political landscape of British Columbia. You see this particularly on the Nechaco, and I think you can see it on the piece first also. I'll speak about the Nechaco, though. Alcan built the first phase of its development on the Nechaco in the 50s. It wasn't until the late 70s that it announced that it wanted to use all of the water that was granted it under its license and expand its power generation and its smelting facilities at Kitimat. In the debate around Alcan's expansion proposal, which some of you might remember, the debate around Kamano completion, it was very clear that the Kamano 1, the Kenny Dam, the first phase, had reconfigured the political landscape of the province in a way that shaped the debate over Kamano completion that occurred in the 90s. The Kenny Dam and Kamano Powerhouse had basically exacerbated the differences among northern communities. There were those who benefited from Alcan's dam and power and those who didn't. And it wasn't a native-non-native division. There were many non-native communities that had nothing good to say about Alcan. It also heightened tensions between North and South. Because Alcan sold its excess power to BC Hydro, there were a lot of people who felt that the real beneficiaries of this development were people in the Lower Mainland, like me, who enjoyed inexpensive power. Now, the opposition to Kamano completion forged alliances between geographically distant groups and culturally distant groups as well, who found common cause in the history of what happened in the wake of Kamano 1. And I think you see the parallel situation in the piece, where the legacy of the Bennett Dam certainly shaped and is shaping the reception of Site C. The question of scale is implicit to all of what I've had to say, and it's what I want to spend the little bit of time I have left talking about. Scale is the key to understanding conflicts over the environment. The impacts that you see depend on the scale of analysis that you use. Historians are pretty good at using temporal scale. They call it periodization. But curiously, environmental historians haven't really been as attentive to it as I think they could. They haven't really problematized time. When environmental historians look at the impacts of dams, they tend to look at the immediate impacts, the reduced flows, the immediate flooding and creating the reservoir, relocations. Well, it's true that we sometimes take a longer view, looking, for example, at the accumulation of mercury. In framing our environmental histories, we do tend to focus on a single rupture, that's associated with the construction of the dam. And while that's important, I'll talk more about that in tomorrow's session, I think we need to be more attentive to what focusing on a single rupture, a single event, lets us see and what it doesn't let us see. In taking a longer view of the impacts of the Kamano project on the Chaco, I was able to see how that development shaped the subsequent political terrain on which future environmental battles were fought. And on the Peace Athabasca Delta, a longer view of the cycles of wet and dry that characterizes huge wetland has provided a completely different context to weigh the impacts of the Bennett. In the long view of cycles of wet and dry, some scientists may say, the dry spell that happened after the Bennett Dam was built was it within the normal range of what happens to that delta. And you can immediately see how those sorts of findings, thinking like a delta in this case, would politicize the debate over compensation. Environmental historians are better, I think, at problematizing scale, and I think in part this comes from the discussion we've had about bioregionalism, you know, what the proper boundaries of analysis are. Should it be ecosystems and rivers, or should it be provinces and nations? But just as we need to move away from focusing on a single rupture, I think we need to move away from focusing on a single spatial scale. When we leave the banks of a particular river and we look beyond the boundaries of a particular watershed and we use a larger scale, we see that the Nechaco was dammed so the Chilco would not be, in order that the salmon, the Fraser run of salmon, was saved. We see that the Peace was dammed because it wasn't the Salmon River, and because, as Jeremy said, it gave the province leverage in negotiations around the Columbia River Treaty. So we have to recognize that damming a river brings different spatial scales into conflict. Continent, nation, province, the basin, community, the body. And it does so in the context of a complex set of contexts, social, political, economic, and biological. And in order to find a way forward, to figure out how we do justice to all the peoples of the rivers, whether they live on their banks or they benefit from the power that flows from them, we need to somehow see where these scales are commensurable, or if they're not, what scale we wish to use, and this is a political decision, in order to assess cost and benefit and compensation.
To hear the rest of the roundtable on the past and future of hydro in BC, including Professor Jeremy Mewitt from the University of Alberta and Professor Paul Hurt from Arizona State University, check out the audio archive on the NICHE website at niche.uwo.ca/podcasts, or visit our show notes at niche.uwo.ca/naturespast. questions about resource development in British Columbia have been particularly prescient in the case of the province's north, with the exploitation of hydroelectric power and natural gas to meet urban North America's growing energy demands. Environmental historians have become more interested in studies of resource exploitation and conflict in BC's north. The Stikine Plateau in northern British Columbia, located between the Coast and Cassiar mountain ranges, is the subject of Jonathan Payton's dissertation research.
I'm Jonathan Payton. I'm a PhD student in the Geography Department at UBC, and my research is on environmental conflict in the Stikine Plateau.
Well, thanks for joining us and coming here to talk about your dissertation research. To start off, why don't you let us know, what are the major early resource conflicts that you're looking at in the Stikine Plateau?
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that you can that I can break them down into three segments. The first major environmental conflict centers around mining and geology in general. As I mentioned, the Gold Rush is the kind of first push, the first major push of the state and of capital into the Stikine. There's a pretty serious booster effort in the Lower Mainland, the Metropole, to use the Stikine as the all-Canadian route to the Klondike Goldfields, so the river itself becomes a transportation conduit. There's a big attempt to build a short-gauge railway from a town called Glenora, which was essentially a town of 10,000 people that cropped up overnight, just down the river from Telegraph Creek.
So to provide context for the Klondike Gold Rush, Vancouver businesses or businessmen are concerned that Seattle is taking most of the traffic,
right?
And
Seattle
that the passage to get through to Klondike goes through Alaska.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's an effort. Instead of having people go up through Skagway and the White Pass, mm-hmm. or Dia, there's an effort to provide an alternative route through kind of a sort of boosterist or nationalist route through the Stikine, up through the Stikine into Teslin Lake, and then up through there.
Okay.
So that has obvious consequences to the natural environment in the Stikine. People use the land, begin to use the land much differently. Animals become commodities. Trees become commodities. So the environment has changed quite drastically. This sort of gives rise to a bunch of small-scale placer mining operations that crop up in the tens and teens, the 1910s and teens. And then there's a whole bunch of other larger-scale gold and copper mining operations, Galore Creek sort of being the largest of those. It's an on-again, off-again operation that is still possibly happening. And then the coal bed methane efforts by Shell in the Klapan Mountain area, what's now being called the Sacred Headwaters. The next sort of major area of conflict is over massive transportation and communication infrastructures developments.
And when is this?
It starts with the effort to build the short gauge railway north of Glenora during the Klondike Gold Rush. But there's a whole series of road and railway building enterprises that most of them ultimately end in failure. This often gets presented, particularly in popular literature, as a kind of episodic series of failures. The Stikine is also used in the 1940s as a kind of transportation conduit to bring in materials to build the Watson Lake airstrip, which is obviously connected to the building of the Alaska Highway. So it's connected in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
There's an attempt to build what's called the Dease Lake Railbed, that is also connected to an attempt to build a bridge over the Stikine, which is shut down weeks or days after its completion, a $3 million bridge in the 1970s. There's the Stewart-Cassiar Highway, which is essentially a well, now mostly paved, but for a long time, essentially a dirt highway through, well, from Hazelton to Watson Lake. And then there's a protracted attempt by BC Hydro to build a series of dams on the Stikine and on the Iskut River. There's five sites identified. And there's a protracted battle over that between BC Hydro and metropolitan environmental groups and local environmental groups, local groups generally.
Then so can you give us an example of the, from the developer perspective, obstacles, or from your perspective, conflicts between different actors who are either seeking to exploit this region for a particular resource or stop that sort of exploitation? What were the obstacles to transportation, let's say, or to mining operations that you've found so far?
I think it has to do with the position of the Stikine. I mean, it's really far away from the metropole. It's often presented through a kind of lens of marginality. The Stikine is in essence a marginal place. And I mean, that's a kind of convoluted way of presenting that. It can be complicated to think about somewhere as marginal, because it's a relative concept. But the Stikine is far away. It's hard to get materials to the Stikine. And the materials required for road building, for instance, are not necessarily readily available. It's also, you know, Galore Creek is the site of Galore Creek, for instance, is far away from everything. so it's in that sense, there's a real economic impetus to have Galore Creek go through, but there are very serious economic and environmental roadblocks to have that are preventing Galore Creek from being a viable being a viable operation.
Is there local opposition to any of these projects?
There's, for sure. Yeah, I mean, most recently, there's been huge opposition to Shell's tenure claim, the coal bed methane tenure claim, in the Clipan Mountain area. It's been documented quite well, actually. There's local environmental groups. The Clibana Keepers are the most active of those groups. There's been a fairly significant schism in the Tahltan community, the local indigenous community, over the way that development should proceed. It's my understanding that elders are generally concerned to enact a kind of program of sustainable development to make sure that there are jobs, long-term job prospects, and that exploitation doesn't occur in a kind of immediate and haphazard way. Mm-hmm. And so there are obvious conflicts there between the state, a large multinational corporation, and local and more metropolitan environmental organizations as well.
Now, you hinted that there are certain physical limits to, let's say, road construction in the Stikine Plateau. What are the limiting factors of the physical environment that have played a role of what you've looked at so far? Can you describe for listeners a little bit of what the region might look like, or the physical characteristics of the region?
I think one of the most striking physical aspects of the region is the Grand Canyon of the Stikine, which starts essentially just upriver from Telegraph Creek. Telegraph Creek is about 250 kilometers upriver from the mouth of the Stikine, and it's essentially the head of navigation, and has been the head of navigation since stern wheelers began patrolling the Stikine in the 1860s. Mm-hmm. So access upriver is extremely difficult. The Grand Canyon is John Muir described it as slightly less spectacular version of the actual Grand Canyon. but So, I mean, those are the kind of limiting factors. It's essentially impenetrable by water, upwards of, or upriver of Telegraph Creek. Geologically speaking, it's a fairly relatively unexplored region. Within the kind of popular literature, it's always referred to as one of the last Canadian wildernesses, because it's because we generally don't know what's underground, what's vertical.
And now that's a perspective certainly from outsiders of the region. How has that perspective of this region shaped the way in which government, businesses, people from outside the Stikine have envisioned this place?
Yeah, yeah, sure. One of the things I'm actually interested in looking at is the interaction between an understanding of placemaking in the Stikine, the way that the Stikine is viewed in the Stikine and elsewhere. So I'd like to look at the interaction between between a kind of these narrative conventions of the Stikine and the way it gets understood elsewhere, and how that's related to the way people interact with the Stikine, to the way the Stikine is developed.
Now, you're researching right now. What sort of sources are you looking at? Where are you traveling? What archives are you going to?
I spent most of the summer in Victoria at the BC Archives, where I think most of the material that I'll be using is located, which is convenient. So I'm looking at government records, DIA, RG10 files. There are lots of diaries and popular accounts of particularly things like the Gold Rush era, hunting and guiding narratives. The Stikine was sportsman's mecca, world famous hunting area. It's one of the things that sort of metaphorically puts it on the map. I'm also planning several research trips, probably Ottawa this summer. I'm going to spend some time up in the Stikine. It's a bunch of stuff in Whitehorse, mostly on the Gold Rush as well. And there may be a trip to Juneau, Alaska, depending on how I draw the parameters of the study.
And is there anything in the future here that may bring you into the region to do field work on the ground?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's a part of what's great about being in a geography department is that there's a real opportunity to do some more contemporary work. So I plan this summer to spend some time in the Stikine, in, well, probably Telegraph Creek primarily, also in Dease Lake and in Iskut, the three major communities there, doing some ethnographic work. That will be mostly around the coalbed methane debate. So there's an opportunity there to do some more contemporary work and bring the notion of resource conflict into the present, because it seems to me there's a real continuity within some of the themes that swirl around resource politics in that area.
Well, thanks for speaking with us today. We're looking forward to seeing what you come up with in your research, and wishing you the best of luck as you head out into the field.
Thanks, Sean.
Nature's Past is produced with support from the Network in Canadian History and Environment. This episode was made by Jocelyn Thorpe, Tina Liu, Jonathan Payton, and me, Sean Karaj. Music for Nature's Past was licensed by Creative Commons. For details on the artists, please take a look at our show notes at niche.uwo.ca/naturespast, where you can also download new episodes and subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. Thanks for listening, and be sure to download our next episode.